ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Don't have enough time to stay across all the latest news? ABC News Top Stories podcast explains the biggest breaking news stories and why they matter in less than 2 minutes. So you can hit play and get updated while brushing your teeth or making your lunch. It's always up to date, ready whenever you're ready to get across the day's news. Just search ABC News Top Stories podcast on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts and hit follow or favourite to add us to your playlist.
Today, the Australian people have voted for Australian values.
The choice is simple for the Liberal Party. Change or die.
We need to have more Australian everything. We need to manifest a hyper-Australia.
We've always been about the planet, but we've got to make sure that people have their daily needs met.
People are starting to see that there is actually a different way of doing politics.
Hello and welcome to The Party Room. I am Patricia Carvelis and I'm joining you from Wurundjeri country in Melbourne.
You are, and I'm Fran Kelly on the Gadigal land of the Eora Nation here in Sydney.
I love it when she fact checks my name.
Yeah, that's right. Got to keep an eye on you, PK. I know. Another huge week, PK. The second week of this conflict in the Middle East. And it's, despite what Donald Trump says again and again, shows no sign of slowing down, does it?
No, that's right, Fran. Although you do get mixed messages from the White House about whether it's close to the completion or, you know, unqualified surrender from Iran. It depends what how
the
you
war
read
is
it.
Over, but not over enough is a direct quote of the US president.
Basically, it could be all over very quickly or could become a forever war. I'm not sure. Either way, people are dying. I think it's a regional war, so it's very much. There is a crisis. There are a lot of Australians still there.
I think the point is it directly affects a lot of Australians who are there and also, as we talked in the podcast, Australians here, because it's going to have a big and immediate economic kickback.
And is happening in real time. So we covered a lot in our regular episode that's still there for you to listen to. We're going to link to that in the show notes so you can catch up after you listen. But Fran, there are many good questions we get, and we've made it a bit of a thing to make special episodes where we answer them rather than sort of rushing with one. So should we start answering them?
I can't wait. Let's do it.
We shall move to questions without notice. Are there any questions? I give the call to the Honourable, the Leader of the Opposition.
Yeah.
Prime Minister.
The bells are ringing. That means it's time for our question time. And this week, our first question comes from Hamish.
Hi, Fran and PK. Hamish calling from Lutruwita, Tasmania here. My question is regarding the war in Iran going on at the moment. With Australia part of the UN and one of the sayings of it being an attack against one is attack against all, if Iran attacks one of the European nations, which it is close to, would that mean Australia has to go in to fight? Thanks. Love the pod.
Good question. Yes, we are absolutely part of the UN, but it's actually NATO, which is the North Atlantic Treaty, that has that Article 5 section about being essentially, you know, activated to respond if one of yours gets hit. So we would not be part of that. We are not obligated. We would make our own autonomous sovereign decision about whether we'd be involved. But if you look at how we've operated with Ukraine, for instance, Fran, I mean, that's pretty obvious. We are not in Europe, but we have taken a very strong position when it comes to Ukraine. We are now involved in this war in a defensive, not offensive role, according to the government. And so far, the evidence is that it's that way. So we wouldn't be obligated, but I think given we are very much aligned with Europe, the US, you would think absolutely we would be making a consideration about that involvement.
Yes, but as you say, we're not a part of NATO. We do have a title. I think it's like a friend of NATO or partner in the region to NATO, which means we get invited to NATO meetings these days. But yeah, we are not bound by that. An attack on one is an attack on all, Article 5 of NATO. So it's as PK says, we have alliances. We have the ANZUS Treaty with the US, which is that if the US is attacked, we get engaged. That's what John Howard invoked after 9/11. That's why Australia got involved in those wars. But I think in this case, it's pretty clear Australia is not going to be drawn full pot in, full full tilt into this war. But there is a consideration. We talked a lot about this yesterday on the podcast, that of many Australians in this region, and therefore our government does have some kind of involvement by default in terms of helping secure them. That's the negotiation, as I understand, that's gone on with the UAE president. And Donald Trump has had direct conversations, we know, with our prime minister. But I think Anthony Albanese is making it pretty clear. This is not going to be an Iraq situation. Australia is not going to put, you know, SAS forces on the ground or troops on the ground. But yes, there is. So there's a level of commitment and responsibility, but it's not that level. We won't be drawn in that way into this war, we hope.
Being drawn into wars has incredibly huge consequences, not only obviously on the troops that go and wear our uniform, but on, I think it's always a really, really consequential decision. Our next question comes from Tommy.
We keep hearing that One Nation's rise is the product of economic grievances, but we also hear that One Nation's support is coming from baby boomers and Gen X. I'm not denying that there are older Australians doing it tough right now, but I think you'd agree that if there are generations with a case to feel economically marginalised, it's millennials and Gen Z. Is there polling that breaks down the One Nation vote by socioeconomic status? Or is it possible that we're being a bit too generous to One Nation voters by saying it's about economic issues rather than predominantly about race? Thanks.
Great question, Tommy. Another great question. So, look, we thought, PK and I, we're not ones to step back from the limelight, but in this case, we thought, why not go straight to the source and ask another friend of this podcast, Cos Samaras. He's a pollster, director of the Redbridge Group. He's a former Labor strategist. He knows a lot about what is going on within this shifting demographic that is voting in greater numbers, it would suggest, or favouring One Nation. Here's Cos.
Yes, One Nation voters do tend to skew lower socioeconomic status. Lower incomes, lower education attainment, more blue collar and precarious work. So the economic grievance story has some truth to it. But here's where the listener's instinct is dead right. If economic stress was the main driver, you'd expect millennial and Gen Z to be flooding into One Nation's hands. They're not. They are the most economically squeezed generation living memory, locked out of housing, drowning in debt, stuck in insecure work, and their political responses look completely different. They're going left, going Greens, or checking out entirely. They are not going to Pauline Hanson. So what explains the gap? Well, I would argue that cultural status anxiety more than economic pain. It's older Australians, particularly outside the major cities, who feel the country they grew up in has been transformed around them without their consent. Immigration is central to that. Demographic change is central to that. And yes, that carries a racial dimension. I don't think we should dance around that either. The honest framing is this: economic stress is the kindling, but anxiety about identity, belonging, and who Australia is becoming, that's the accelerant. And reducing One Nation support purely to hypocrisy concerns lets a lot of voters and, frankly, a lot of commentators off the hook for a much harder conversation that we must all have.
Isn't Cos fantastic, PK? I mean, thank you so much, Cos, for helping us out here. PK, that was just a brilliant contribution, didn't you think?
Yeah, he is, and he's very helpful to us, so I think he's kind of answered it. But I do think the question more broadly, though, and like he's the expert, but I do watch it pretty closely. I think there are so many layers to what we're seeing here with the rise of One Nation. And one of the problems we have is that we love a binary. It's this or it's this. And so many things, right? And it's so much about the vibe of the thing sometimes. And of course, that's why we've all been desperately waiting for some real results, some real ballot papers, my friends, where some real people have to really put numbers in them to see what that looks like. South Australia, later in the year, Victoria.
The Farrah by-election.
Boom. Same person we are in different clothes. You know what I'm saying. So until that happens, we're going to have a lot of theories. I'm still waiting for that.
Yeah, and I think that point you make about the binary is really important. And I was struck by Matt Canavan's contribution when he gave his first press conference as leader of the Nats, and he basically brushed the binary away. He wasn't buying into the people of the regions versus people in the, you know, inner urban suburbs. He wasn't talking far left. He's making this big pitch where Australians feel all sorts of things. And I think he could be onto something there, PK, that not everyone who is signalling to the pollsters that they're supporting One Nation are low-income, lesser-educated, outer urban or rural regional voters. They're not. COZ's own polling, Redbridge polling, shows that one out of four millennial men were inclined or said they would potentially vote One Nation. That's a big number. So I think he's understanding this binary thing. It's something more than that. It'll be interesting to see how he goes with that.
Our next question comes from Dia, who sent it to me privately too.
Ooh.
And she has this question.
Hi, PK. I never do this, but I'm about to go on holiday, so I can ask you a question as a civilian for the party room, which happens to be date night listening for me and my partner, because we are such nerds. I keep hearing on podcasts that the rise of the far right in Australia is related to the cost of living, inflation, and people locked out of the housing market. But I'm wondering if that's entirely correct. We live in such different algorithmic universes now, and I'm wondering if what unites people, if what the common denominator is of these people who are flirting with or supporting One Nation, is what they're listening to or reading to or what the algorithm brings up on their screens. Perhaps it's everything all at once, but I'd love to hear what the party room thinks.
Really interesting question, Dia, and thanks for sending it to me. Okay. I think you are onto something. I think, and we discussed it a bit with the kind of economic angles, socioeconomic issues that we raised and COZ dealt with. I do think economic grievance still is a big part of the story. I really do, right? Because you're seeing the rise as you're seeing sort of inflation stuck, sort of sense of frustration and a fracturing of the right. So you're seeing all of that happen. But we cannot ignore the fact that we are all living in altered universes. You know, it's everyone's heard this before, but you're going to hear it again. We do not sit down. I wish we did, because some of the legacy things we've been working on for years, Fran and I, are in decline as a result, right? We don't sit down. Like, I will be honest, I catch up with the news. I don't go, oh my God, sorry, girls, I've got to run. It's 7 o'clock. Now,
you're
I have
not
some
on
friends.
The couch at 7 o'clock at
no,
home
but
with
I
the
have
kids.
Some friends that still are, right? Some people still are. So we're in a transitional spot. I'm not. I do watch it though, but I catch up.
And I hope everyone is listening to the Radio National Hour at 6 p.m.
but people are. They're downloading it later. So there's different ways we're doing it all. But my point is we're all in different algorithms and different universes. We're not all collectively coming at once and all seeing one form of information. So if you get down the algorithmic hole, I know because my partner, I'll tell you, I don't know if she wants me to share this, but I will. She's down a bit of an algorithmic hole of sometimes some of this bro stuff, right? I think she clicked on something once. She's like, oh my God, right? Like the workout stuff, all of that stuff, right? You get more and more. You get more and more. Now, as soon as that stuff becomes political, then maybe you're watching more of it. You're starting to think, this sits right with me. And I think that is, Dia is right. That is part of the story here, that it's been more normalised. You're hearing more of these theories. That's what you're seeing. And therefore, you're getting fed more of it. I just reckon that is a big part of it, but it's not the only part. What do you think, Fran?
Yeah, I think that's right. I'm remembering that a couple of weeks ago when we were talking about the, you know, Susan Lee was going to be rolled and Charlotte Mortlock resigned from that Liberal women's group that she'd started up, Hilma's Network. And she talked about our politicians being algorithmed. And I just thought it was great to use it like that as a verb. I think that's a verb.
I love that too. It was her best moment, wasn't
it? Yeah, being algorithmed. And I think that's more and more, as you say, we all know it. We're operating in our own ecosystems. We go to the same sites, the same social media. We follow the same social media people all the time. We're living in these ecosystems and we are separate in a way that we weren't even 10 years ago, I think. And in order for legacy media and any of these sites really to get an audience, they need to even more sensationally follow down a track. They need to narrow cast because that's how they can preserve some base, you know. Mm-hmm. If you're too blah blah, if you're too melange, if you're too vanilla, no one's going to rush to you, I think. Well, fewer people will rush to you. So I think this is a product of the media landscape as it is. And that's why I hark back to that comment I made about Matt Canavan, he's clearly trying to go above that and talk about Australia, you know, Australian jokes, Australian barbecues, Australians having more babies. I don't know how it's going to work for him, but I think, yeah, dear, you've really, you know, hit something on the head here, that this is a problem, and I don't think our politicians have any clue on how to deal with it and broaden out their messages.
Yeah. Excellent question. And it's the ongoing question about algorithms and our changed environment and how it's changing us.
Because I do think there is something too, though, PK, to the underlying issues that, you know, fears about immigration have been a hallmark of this country since we arrived in the First Fleet. It really has been. And it was only in the early 70s that Gough Whitlam got rid of the White Australia policy. So I think there are deep-seated fears, by and large, across the Australian community about immigration numbers, and they are heightened every time there are cost of living pressures, infrastructure pressures, unemployment pressures.
I think that's right. I remember many things said to my parents in my life, and I can tell you that this is not a new story. And then you feel more like, oh, yeah, you're into our club. And then a new group comes. George Megalogenis has written about this. There's a new group. And now we are going through that again. But it's been turbocharged by the new environment online. And it's getting uglier, truthfully. It is getting uglier than it's ever been because it can get uglier. There are the tools there to make it exactly that. So, yeah, it's a real thing. And I think we need to do, I think actually, and I know academics are, I think there needs to be a lot more work on it actually to really understand just the extent of how much it might be radicalizing people and changing the way we think. Now, next question comes from Eamon, who has a question on Farah.
Good afternoon, Fran and PK. Eamon from Port Hedland here. My question to you is, why wouldn't the Prime Minister and the Labor Party be interested in running a person in the upcoming Farah by-election? It does seem like they would be unlikely to win any contest, but if nothing else, it feels it would give them the opportunity to funnel the votes to a more friendly party through their preferences. And if nothing else, it would be a good temperature check for the federal government to see how they are actively polling against One Nation. Thanks.
PK, I've wondered this myself, why Labor wouldn't try and go here. They've got not much to lose. They've got, you know, this massive majority in the parliament. They're not under threat. A defeat in this by-election means very little to them. It's not a seat people would expect them to win. I think they've got, you know, the coffers are pretty well stocked by dint of the fact that they got so many votes, you know, at the last election across so many seats, if nothing else. And we know that donations to the Liberal Party are really, really sunk. So I thought they might take this chance to put pressure on the Liberal Party in particular, make them spend more, make them exert more, make the stakes higher for them. There's not much to gain from it, as Eamon says, in terms of they're not going to win. But there is also the question if they could funnel friendly votes, you know, to friendly independents. So I'm not exactly clear why they haven't done it, except that maybe they would be criticised for just trying to be a wedge, just trying to be a spoiler here. I don't know. I mean, clearly the battle here is amongst the Conservative parties, I think, isn't it?
Yeah, I think the battle is between the Conservative parties. I think that's absolutely right. Look, we've got one more question I reckon we can sneak in, and it's from Nathan.
Hey, PK and Fran. My name's Nathan. So the Liberal Party review outlines that the difficulty with women has less to do with the party itself and more to do with the leadership creating obstacles. Is there any evidence that the leadership actually recognises their own role in this and any responsibility in how they've created this issue?
Look, I think that's a fair point, Nathan, that the leadership for more than a decade, a couple of decades now, have, for instance, just sort of, you know, absolutely blanked any notion of quotas, even though they're the number of female candidates getting pre-selected to safe seats has gone down, 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 and their representation now in the parliament is abysmal. It's embarrassing. And I don't think the signs are great. I mean, I mentioned this, I think, on the podcast a few weeks back. When Angus Taylor had his first press conference as leader, he was asked about the Liberals' women problem. And his response was, well, we want to attract women and men. which is really kind of beside the point. So I think there's a sense that the leadership is not focused on this as they are. And if they're not focused, then they have a responsibility and a role for perpetuating the problem, because that means they're not actively working out a way to deal with it. And I think that's why we saw the likes of Charlotte Mortlock and others leave the party at that time. So, you know, I think to some extent, that's what you're saying is true. And then the other reflection is, what does the leadership look like, and what's it signalling to the broader electorate?
Yeah, I think the way that the leadership deals with those questions of gender is important. Look, I think going into this, Angus Taylor is aware of the way it looks. I think he, even though the ballot works independently, I think him really making it clear he would like Jane Hume to be the person who is his deputy was part of that story. You know, like, that's not a mistake. He made another decision, which was Claire Chandler being his finance spokesperson. Now, lots of reasons for that. Bit of factional, up and comer, some people saying she hadn't got enough experience. But I think, again, it was him trying to send a signal, I'm putting a woman in this finance role. You know what I mean? Like, he's trying to do some of this, but it's going to be more than just that. They're going to have to take
and
a
lot
more
structural change. Yes. And it's not like they haven't been told this election after election, right?
Oh, mate. I mean, if I was asked to write another review for the Liberal Party.
I wish you would be.
Can you imagine? If I was, I would say, nah. Why would you? Like, all the other ones, you don't seem terribly interested in even entertaining. Like, you know, you've got to look like you're maybe a little serious on some of its themes. Now, to be fair, because we've to stick to facts, Angus Taylor has told people absolutely he's going to look at this, and he understands some of the messages here. So he is saying that. But until we see some evidence of the shifts, and I have not seen lots of them yet, then we won't know if it's just lip service or if it's real.
And let's face it, Susan Lee had said it too.
She did say it. No one made it very easy for her though. But that's another podcast.
Well, that's almost the answer to the question perhaps. But anyhow.
Such a good point. That's it for the Party Room today. Keep sending your questions in. We love getting them. We like making these special episodes. There'll be more. Don't worry. Fran and I, we've got a deal. We're coming back.
We'll
send
be
them
back
to thepartyroom@abc.net.au.
And don't miss Insiders on Background on Saturday in the feed. David Spears has a blockbuster this weekend. He's speaking with Dennis Richardson, former boss of ASIO, of course, about his shock exit from the Royal Commission into anti-Semitism and social cohesion. And then, PK, you're back with Politics Now on Monday. Too much politics is never enough.
No, and it won't be a sitting week next week, but it'll still be spicy, I suspect. So, yeah, absolutely. Listen to all of those episodes. See you, Fran.
See you, PK.